Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Hey, this is the Shotaholic reminding you that while you listen to the Talking Metal podcast, come on over and hang out with us on the Talking Metal forum.
This Sunday at 11:30, the Independent Film Channel presents Z-Rock, a new comedy series about three guys.
The girls love it.
Who are in a rock band by night. And a kids band by day. Z-Rock, based on a kind of true story, with special guests Sebastian Bach, John Popper, Gilbert Gottfried, Dee Snider, Dave Navarro.
Who here has banged Carmen Electra?
And Joan Rivers.
I'm very excited. You can't tell because I had the Botox this morning.
Z-Rock premieres this Sunday at 11:30, only on IFC, the Independent Film Channel.
The best hard rock, the best heavy metal, Talking Metal, a podcast hosted by Mark Striegel and John Astronomy. Available through iTunes and most other podcast providers. Feel the power, feel the glory, TalkingMetal.com.
Hey guys, Mark here again. We're going to get right into an interview we did with Rick Ernst and Rat Skates. Rick is the director-producer of a great documentary called Get Thrashed that we're going to talk all about, and Rat Skates, formerly of Overkill, is actually the associate producer on the documentary. And they both stopped by the Talking Metal Studios to hang out and talk with us about their great documentary, Get Thrashed. This interview was recorded a few weeks back. Definitely pick up your copy of Get Thrashed by using those links in today's show notes. We'll have everything linked on TalkingMetal.com. And you guys got to check this out. I was fortunate enough to see this a while ago. I actually mentioned it on our Talking Metal on Fuse TV show. It is a really, really solid, excellent documentary, even for people who don't like metal. So be sure to get it on your Netflix. I actually recommend that you go purchase it. And again, use those show notes to get our links to Get Thrashed, the DVD documentary by Rick Ernst and Rat Skates. Keep in touch with us by sending us an email at talkingmetal@yahoo.com. Check out our site. We're constantly throwing updates on Talking Metal. We always have pictures for each and every podcast that we put up. There are pictures that go along with it that you can get on TalkingMetal.com. So please visit that. Support the Independent Film Channel. Use that link. Go over to IFC.com and show them that TalkingMetal.com is sending them links. I actually am really enjoying the Z-Rock TV show that IFC currently has on Sunday nights at 11:30. So definitely tune into that also. And without further ado, here's Rick Ernst, John Astronomy, Rat Skates, and myself.
Hey guys, welcome to a very special edition of Talking Metal. We are here with the guys from Get Thrashed, Rick Ernst, director and producer, and original founding member of Overkill, Rat Skates. How you guys doing?
Good. What's going on, great. John? Hey, Mark. A special edition. Excellent.
Yes.
So guys, thanks for joining us, and we are pretty psyched because Get Thrashed, the story of thrash metal, is finally about to come out on DVD. So everybody will be able to go purchase this and check it out in the comfort of their own homes, bring the true history of thrash home with them. How did you guys first come together and come up with the idea to do kind of the definitive documentary that would trace the history of thrash?
Pretty much at the end of 2002, I started my own production company and started to think about a project. You know, what would be the ultimate project if I could work on this? You know, I'd have a blast doing it. And I just had to look no further than my record collection to see all my old records and say, of course, duh. You know, you should be doing a documentary on thrash metal. Nobody's ever done this before. It's something you love. And, you know, if I interview all these bands, number one, I'll get to meet them because I've never met most of them before. And number two, even if I just sat in my room and watched this footage, I mean, I'm a fan. So that's cool. And it turned into a lot more than that. And that's really where it started, really as, something that I was passionate about and nobody had told the story of thrash metal before. I wanted to do it. I thought I could do it and do it justice. And it kind of took off from there. And then about, 2004, we hooked up?
Yeah, actually late 2003, early 2004. And the way that happened is, consequently, I had the same idea maybe a year later that I wanted to do a documentary as an indie filmmaker on the thrash metal movement in the early and mid-80s as I experienced it as a musician. So someone who I still am friends with from back in the day, when I told him this idea, he said, you know what, someone's already doing this. I'm like, you're kidding. Passed me along the website and everything. I saw Rick was well into it at that point already. He had shot a decent amount of interviews. And I said, this looks great. If nothing else, let me get in touch with him. I have a ton of memorabilia and things from the day. Maybe I can contribute. So one thing led to another. We got together. I did an interview, showed him what I could do, mainly graphically. All the photo animations that you see in Get Thrashed are mostly mine. And one thing led to another. We teamed up. We had definitely had the same vision for what we wanted in the end to tell that story. And what, the rest is history? Do I need to say that?
The funny thing is, I'll never forget the day we first spoke on the phone.
Yeah.
I was at VH1 working on a Britney Spears versus Christina Aguilera special. So in the midst of that, here I am talking to Rat Skates, and he said, how can I help? And I said, I need a good lawyer. He said, I can't do that. But, After Effects and Photoshop and editing and everything else, I can do. And that's kind of how we hooked up.
Well, I think what's really great is that you're getting it from both of the sides that we're going to want to get the story from: a fan, somebody who's been there for the, from the beginning, and one of the artists,
right,
who was one of the founding members, not only of Overkill, but of thrash in general.
Yeah, and that was really important overall in the film, because you are getting, you're getting extreme sort of looks at what happened, and including the musicians in the film. Because when Rick showed me some of the rough cuts that he had at that point, and there were some of the newer bands that I had heard of, but I'm not really that familiar with, I'm truly stuck in the 80s. What can I say?
Me too.
But yeah, well, there you go. We got the hair and that's all good. We'll, yeah. While we still have it, we'll keep the feathered David Cassidy, Keith Partridge kind of style. Right? And the thing is, it was very interesting hearing their perspective. I instantly felt, as we were talking about earlier, Mark, I felt old when I heard him say, growing up on Overkill, when I was a little kid and listening to Slayer, I'm like, wow, all right. Yeah. So, okay, I'm dated there. But it was interesting hearing their perspective, because as a musician, helping to break that genre in that time period, I never got to hear how it influenced the artists of today. So that was very, very cool. I was not aware that that many of those musicians of the day were that influenced by it. So it was cool.
Now, Rick, you mentioned the Christina Aguilera special you were working on at the time. But just to fill a little some of the listeners in on your history, you definitely were involved in metal programming at MTV Networks. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I straight out of college went to work on Headbangers Ball, the first edition of that with Ricky Rackman, and was there towards the tail end of that. So that was a great experience to be there for, I guess it was a year and a half maybe before it went under, and I got to see the shows that came after that. And basically I've been at MTV since 1993. A lot of metal shows have come along and gone since then. But, ultimately I ended up, the last job I did for MTV was actually MTV2, the supervising producer of the new Headbangers Ball. So it was great to kind of walk in the door as an unpaid intern on the first one and then walk out the door as, the producer on the last version of Headbangers.
Yeah, so the two perfect guys, I would say, to do a documentary on thrash.
We agree.
Yeah. Now, this was many years in the making, right? I mean, I remember running into you years and years ago when you had already started working on it. How long? I know Ian Christie has very long hair in the interview, and his hair is no longer that long. So how long did this actually take? When did it actually start, and when was the final completion?
You know, late 2002 is when I kind of put pen to paper and started putting the wheels in motion. I guess it must have been March 2003 is really when that first batch of interviews took place. So from March 2003 until September 2008, it's just over 5 years. And I did think it was going to take about 5 years to get it out on DVD. It's taking a little bit longer, reasons I'm sure we'll talk about soon. But 5 years, a little over 5 years in the making.
Now, how did you get from the point where once you've had it together, you know, you got it on the big screen all around the U.S.? How did you do that?
You know, doing an independent film like this, it's tough to kind of raise your head above all the clutter that's out there. There's a lot of really good documentaries, a lot of bad documentaries, but there's a lot of material out there. So you have to find a way to kind of pop your head through the clouds there and break through, you know? So, you know, we certainly used metal websites like Blarrymouth and other sites, our site, you know, GetTheRash.com, putting clips up and whatnot to help spread the word. But I think really one of the biggest things that helped was doing the film festival run, which was about a year around the world. We did film festivals, and it was amazing to go to, you know, the UK, or I don't know anybody, but you go to a screening in the UK and, you know, there's 150 people in the theater. You know, it's packed and people are screaming and they're so excited to see the movie and to see us, to see Rat and I. And that was the first kind of inkling, like, wow, this is, you know, more than just, you know, a documentary that we did. I think it's something that the fans took ownership over. And as I was doing documentary, you know, the film festivals around the U.S. and around the world, that became like the running theme. And that really, I think, helped spread the word, you know, that this was a really cool film and a cult kind of film.
Yeah,
in
definitely
a way.
A cult thing, because the thrash metal people in general, I mean, to this day, I mean, you know, it's a very, very intense, hardcore, underground devotion to that. And there were no other films. There are no other films that are on, like, for example, Sam Dunn's film is an excellent film.
Journey.
And it's about metal. It casts a much wider net than ours, which is very, very targeted. So that enthusiasm of the thrash fans, knowing it's about thrash metal, I mean, for example, like in Los Angeles, you know, and the film's coming on and the Slayer section, there's kids, you would think that they're at a concert, standing up yelling, screaming at the, wow, you know, like fist banging, and there's no music yet, just like they're just so excited.
Psyched.
Yeah, I'm going to see what I know is like ultimate here, and I am part of this. And so it was just a great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The film festival experience was was amazing. You know, it was the first time I had seen anything I'd ever done on a big screen. You know, I worked at MTV and had seen stuff on TV that I'd produced and directed, but this was the first time seeing it on a big screen. And it was amazing. And like Rat said, you go to these different screenings and, you know, even more than the good reviews, like I've met friends that I'll have for the rest of my life from going to Texas for the first time and having people so, you know, so psyched to see the movie and so appreciative that we did this movie, that somebody did it, you know, and that's the amazing thing, you know, from people all around the world. I have friends now just through this movie and showing them this movie and going there and screening.
One of the things that I think is great is that you actually had a section that focuses on the fans. I learned a lot from it, but what is also notable is that the fans feel like they're part of the movie, even if you weren't in the movie. You just feel like this whole movement is something that you were a part of, which you know, brings up, like, for example, the Old Bridge Militia. I mean, I never knew that they existed, but it was so cool to see that, you know, this guy had all this land, and if the, you know, a certain band couldn't play at a certain club, they'd go to his house and play. That is totally insane. Yeah. And I'm sure you probably played there a number of times.
Well, we were part of, again, a group of people that were... The Old Bridge Militia were guys who were not musicians, but they wanted to be a part of what was going on at that time. And so there's a whole big story on how Metallica stayed there for 6 months, something like that. The fan aspect of it, because like you say, they're a part of it in the film, having a section and a section on the road and everything. It's definitely this film is possible because Rick is an extremely thorough guy. All right, and
we really couldn't have done this film without the fans, essentially. You know, the fans basically, you know, before I met Rat, before I met the web guy, Doug Sexton, who does the website, it was all me doing everything. And, you know, I went out onto the web there and I basically asked fans to help. Send in your ticket stubs, send in your pictures, send in your stories. You know, let's do this, but I need your help. And pretty much, you know, all throughout the making of the film, they helped. You know, the photographers who helped were huge fans. Frank White, you know, and he's a professional photographer. But there are people that are simply fans that sent in materials that, you know, their names are in the credits. They were a big, big part of it. You know, there weren't a lot of people outside of me and Rat that worked on this thing. So when you look at the credits, there are a lot of fans in there that submitted materials. And, you know, they were a big part of it in terms of making it. And they're a big part of it when you do feel, I think, that if you're a fan, you watch this. This is my movie. This is my scene. That's what I've heard people tell me over and over again. Thank you for making a movie about my scene, about my life growing up as a thrash metal fan. And that is so cool to hear that. It's so cool.
And it could not have happened without those contributions.
Yeah. Rat, no, I wanted to ask you, maybe you can fill in some of our younger listeners who weren't even alive when thrash music came about.
Ask the old guy. Okay.
I'm asking one of the founding fathers of the genre.
Thank you.
Where it came from? There was punk rock in the 70s. There was hard rock. There was even metal. But where did this insane sound that became known as thrash metal actually come from?
Thrash metal came from the American kids reinterpreting the new wave of British heavy metal, because the new wave of British heavy metal, Iron Maiden, Saxon, these bands that had stepped things up quite a bit, as with American culture to this day, we take everything to extremes. And that's really what, you know, we were in our early 20s, that's what we had done at that point. We used to live for the import section of the record stores. And then out of that became underground tape trading, cassette trading of demos and everything. But it was basically, you know, metal was ready to jump to another extreme level. And, you know, we were the guys that were capable, I guess, musically, and just had the aggression as people to make this to make this transference into this new style at that point. But it is very much from the new wave of British heavy metal. The other thing that in Get Thrashed that we couldn't, you see, Get Thrashed is like a tree, and it has a root, you know, and then there's branches, and you can't go into every leaf of every branch, you know, because
right.
There were so many thrash bands by the end of the scene, so to speak, in late 80s or whatever. So we tried to have, obviously, the strongest components in the film, but there was like a gray area in 80, 81, 82 with Anvil, with Raven, Exciter, these kind of bands who were very, very important. They weren't quite thrash bands, but they certainly stepped up what traditional metal was at that point. So it just basically, you know, came from that reinterpretation of the new wave of British heavy metal and us trying to outdo each other. You know, who's going to play double bass faster in the next song and have a chunkier sound? And there you go. It's like a race.
How much did hardcore and punk play into the influence when you were young and listening to bands?
That ultimately is what changed it and made it took a curve at that point, because the SOD record in 85 when that came out, and it was clearly a hardcore record with a metal sound, with a very, very heavy sound. And so that was a turning point. A lot of things changed at that time, because they were playing so aggressively, harder than we were. We were maybe better musicians than some of the hardcore guys, but they admired the fact that we could play. So as we have a section of crossover in Get Thrashed, it explains very well how the thinking was kind of exchanged between the two genres, and we borrowed from each other. And eventually, when we all realized we can get along in the same club and we're, you know, just going to have fun and not hurt each other, because one guy's a skin, one guy's a long hair, there you go. And that's what defined it, I guess, as thrash metal, you know, as that label.
Now, as another drummer, I'm curious, what were your influences in your drumming and being one of the first ever thrash drummers?
I may be different than some of the other drummers from the thrash era, the early thrash era, because I studied jazz drumming growing up. I was traditionally trained, can read, and consequently taught lessons and things like that. But I grew up, my probably at the time, my biggest influence was Tommy Aldridge. He was an arena rock drummer.
Right.
Certainly was Tommy Lee's influence, I mean, without question, from the way his kit is set up to stick twirling and just, you know, very exaggerated playing. And he was the first drummer that I remember being very much noticed. You know, from a distance, he was still, it wasn't this guy hiding and playing softly. So anyway, I'm influenced more by that kind of, you know, Neil Peart, Tommy Aldridge, and then I like a lot of like other stuff, jazz fusion and whatnot. But that's me.
Wow, that's great. I didn't know that you had that background in jazz drumming, because I mean that kind of stuff is really complex. I mean, just me being a drummer, I could probably fake my way through a jazz song. But anybody who knew what they were doing would say, "Oh, that's like some rock guy trying to play jazz. I can't do it right."
I think with most of the guys from my era, from the very earliest days of thrash, listening to and appreciating other kinds of music, not necessarily playing it, but appreciating it, understanding it, made you a better player in the long run.
Definitely.
You know, it gave you more tools in your tool bag to work with, right?
Cool. Well, thank you for that.
Rick, growing up when you were a kid, what were some of your first memories of discovering thrash and hearing that sound that was definitely different for the first time?
I mean, I kind of grew up on AC/DC, Sabbath, Priest, Maiden, and you know, you just kind of take it to the next level. And I remember somebody, a friend of a friend, floating me a mix tape cassette in high school, and it had Possessed, and I think it had Overkill, Creator, and Nuclear Assault, Hanging the Pope. I'll never forget listening to that, going, "Oh my God, I'm never gonna listen to this stuff. This is crazy," you know. And of course, you know, years later, here I am doing a documentary. But that was the first introduction, and my first, you know, reaction was, "My God, this is too much. It's just too much." And I remember another time when I was about to go out. I only had enough money to buy one record, and I said, you know, to my friend, you know, a little older, had a little bit more money than me. I said, "Should I go out and buy Metallica, Kill 'Em All, or Wasp, you know, the first Wasp album?" He said, "You should buy the first Wasp album." So that delayed my Metallica purchase by about 2 months before I went back and actually was able to buy it. So,
well, I think it's funny because Sully from Godsmack said the same thing. When he first heard thrash, he was like, "This stuff sucks." But then, like, you know, like a couple of weeks later, he was like, "This is the greatest thing
I had the same reaction as Sully did from Godsmack." And, you know, I think that's a really... It's a great line, because it absolutely summed up where I was when I first heard thrash.
Yeah, and once you could get past in those early days, a lot of the people listening to it and hearing how fast and heavy it was, they didn't know what to make of it. But once you gave it a chance and you realized there's really some good songwriting behind all this. There's structure. A guy like James Hetfield, who can really, really sing very well. He's got such power and a gruff to his voice. But the guy had a melody line. That's the one component that ended up being, over the years, removed from thrash metal, is the melodic, any sort of melody whatsoever, especially vocal-wise. And really, kind of, that's where it stands today, because that's the biggest change is, in my opinion, vocally. What's going on, of course, the drop tuning, you know, that's a given now, but...
People were talking about Joey Belladonna being one of the melodic singers of thrash as well.
Yeah.
And but you're right. Like nowadays, you know, that's not present currently
in a lot of bands. But. No, because now I think what it is, because I talked before about the extremity and everything being an extreme, and metal has always been an extreme. When a singer screams, that's his extreme point. That's his best tool in his tool bag. So, right, and so the double bass playing, like, well, let's do double bass every song. Let's do it real fast. And let me scream every lyric. So you kind of reach,
like,
a wall.
Yeah, you can't go
where
any
do you go?
Higher than that. It's almost cooler to not have double bass all throughout every song and not have screaming, because then you have, you know, peaks and valleys,
and dynamics, and now it's one thing. It's heavy,
it's just kind of full on, and there's no
That's why
dynamics.
I think when you get guys that can, you know, scream and do the heavy stuff as well as sing, somebody like a Corey Taylor from Slipknot and Stone Sour, I mean, that is amazing when you hear that, for somebody to be able to seamlessly go between the different styles of vocals, and in Corey Taylor's case, different styles of music, you know, seamlessly. That I think is the coolest thing. Yeah, you can sing heavy and gruff and death metal or Cookie Monster vocals all the time, and you know, a lot of that stuff I actually, you know, I do like and I appreciate it. But you know, I find when there's, you know, more variety in the singing, I like it a lot more.
There's so many great people interviewed in the documentary. Who was the hardest person to lock down?
Dave Mustaine.
Dave Mustaine, really?
Yeah, you don't have to even finish. Okay. Simply because if fans of Megadeth remember, there was a time where Dave had injured his arm and he wasn't in Megadeth. There was no Megadeth. They were kind of in limbo. Yeah, and that was right around the time we were trying to, you know, get this documentary going, and I was trying to find Dave, and I couldn't. And until he basically came back and put an album out, and at the time he was on Sanctuary Records, then that was the point where I could actually, you know, grab a hold of somebody who had, a phone number of Dave Mustaine that could actually deliver him to be interviewed. He was the hardest one, no doubt. You know, he was one of the most important one. He's one of the best guys in the film. So when people say, how come it took so long? Well, there were certain guys we had to get. And I don't think I interviewed Dave until like 2005. So it was pretty far along until we got a hold of him.
His interview was one of my favorites. And one of the things that I like that he said is he said, you know, I'm not going to try to, you know, when I'm putting together Megadeth, I'm not going to try to, you know, outdo Metallica or be better because I was the best thing in the band. He said something like
right,
that. I can't
exactly
remember word for word.
Yep.
But then the other thing that he said is that he said that he had influenced, like, guitar players in Slayer. So his sound influenced Kerry King, right. James.
Yeah, he takes a lot of credit. He has no problems with that at
all. You know, the interesting thing is that, you know, along those lines, we were at the UK screening, which actually was the premiere of the film at the Rain Dance Film Festival, and Malcolm Dome, famous journalist,
from
was there.
Krang and,
and at every film festival, those lines get kind of chuckles, but I always remember Malcolm afterwards at a club we went to saying, you know what, everybody was laughing about Dave saying that, but it's fucking
true. Right, it's
you
true.
Know?
Right.
I mean, and that was pretty... That hit home, you know, because even I, you know, took it, you know, as, okay, there's Dave being Dave. But until Malcolm said that, that's what really set in as these, you know, these revered journalists that are saying, you know what, they might be laughing, but Dave's right.
Right, he is.
Yeah, because with any ego, you know what, it's justifiable if you can back it up. And he
can do it.
He can back it up. There were a few things that he said that we didn't put in the final cut.
Wow.
That are along those same lines. He right with the...
Yeah, I mean,
maybe someday that'll come out on its separate. Yeah,
outtakes.
Right, outtakes.
Exactly. I mean,
ultimately, if it applied to the film and it made sense to put it in there, it would have been in there. But, you know, if it's extraneous stuff, we always looked at it as a train going down the track. And if we were just putting it in there to be salacious or to create controversy, it really didn't make any sense. We wanted to tell a story that flowed from A to B to C nicely, and you can also follow. So to just put, like, Dave lines in there that maybe, you know, are inflammatory or egotistical, it just would have been for the sake of putting it in there rather than helping tell a story, which is what the ultimate goal was.
I have a question for you guys about who had the first commercial success with thrash, for example, on MTV. And was it Peace Sells? Was that more successful than, you know, that came before some of the more successful Metallica videos?
Yeah, if you're talking about successful thrash videos, It might have been Peace Sells, because that would have come before One, which was Metallica's first video. You know, around 86, you would have also probably had Indians from Anthrax, which was a big, big video for them. Those might have been the two biggest videos that I can remember. I didn't have MTV at the time, so this is years later, me looking back at some of the videos that, you know, MTV had in their library. And I think those are the two that would have been the biggest ones.
I was always out when that was on.
When you think of the big bands, I mean, you think of immediately the big four: Metallica, Megadeth, Anthrax, and Slayer. And certainly Anthrax with Indians and Megadeth Peace Sells. Those are the two videos I remember from the earliest thrash videos.
It's just interesting that, like, Metallica, the One video didn't come out until after the Megadeth video was successful. So that was kind of just like a you know, I kind of always felt bad for Mustaine because of what happened with Metallica. But, you know, he really saw success, commercial success, like on MTV first.
Well, I mean, with Metallica, too, there was that whole, I remember for years and years, they would say, we're never going to do a video. We'll never do a video. Yeah. When you look back on it now, and Rat, you might be able to comment on that. Was that a marketing ploy in itself? Like, we're not going to do a video, and that made the hardcore fans even more excited, or made people more curious about them, and it gave them more street cred?
Well, if you think about it, look at Chinese Democracy is supposed to come out 10 years ago.
Right.
Maybe that will never actually come out.
Right.
It'll be the biggest album that never was. So the hype sure, the hype is going to sell something, even if there's not a product behind it at some point, you know, if you think about it. So, yeah, I mean, they could say all those things, but at the end of the day, and, you know, cash is king. And so at that time, yeah, maybe just the marketing.
I definitely think it helped fuel the fire. You know, me as a fan, hearing them say that, it was kind of like rallying against the man at that point, you know, because,
right.
you know, they were the band and they were standing up against the establishment, not just MTV, but even radio wasn't playing them at the time either. So the fact that, you know, your band that you found, you discovered, and there's a select group of people that like them, you, on a certain level, you don't want other people to discover your special band.
Well, it's
so it was cool.
Because when I remember when the video came out for One and Justice was out, and I remember walking into a Macy's at Quaker Bridge Mall in Trenton, New Jersey, and there they were in Macy's, the Metallica t-shirts. And I was so upset because I was like, you know, these guys have done a video, and now look at Macy's is selling Metallica t-shirts. And it in a way, you know, it was never as exciting for me that point, you know.
Because something that's sacred to you and special to just you, and you know you understand it, all of a sudden the world, you know, is trying to experience it. And they don't necessarily get it. It's kind of like, you know, wearing the Misfits Fiend shirt. You know, I saw the Misfits back at that time period, and there's a place for them in my heart. But it's, you know, become something that just gets mainstream, and it's just like
Coca-Cola is now called Coke. It just becomes, you know, one generic brand. And then
the punk stuff, especially the Misfits, the Ramones.
We were you know, my son here is wearing a Dead Boys t-shirt, and huge Dead Boys fans. And a Dead Sonic Reducer, right? Steven showed up on Tony Hawk Pro Skater, you know, and all of a sudden he was really, really mad. It's not sacred anymore. You know, it's not a special thing. Now, every kid who has a skateboard is going to be listening to the Dead Boys.
Right.
It doesn't work. They don't get it. They don't get it.
on that tip, it really ties into something Rick said too, and I didn't know that anybody other than my, you know, group of a couple of friends in small town Pennsylvania used this terminology, but it was discovering bands. The only band I ever discovered was Metal Church.
That's a big discovery, though.
Yeah,
great band.
But we almost had to be, you had to be deemed cool enough by the group of friends to be able to go purchase a specific album. I remember one time I bought an album and the group didn't deem me cool enough, and people were hanging up the phone on me because they said, "Oh, we didn't authorize you to go buy that Metallica record." Yeah.
It was totally like that at my school too. You
absolutely
know?
I still remember sitting at lunch, and I can vividly remember the first Testament album, you know, the Legacy versus Exodus, Pleasures of the Flesh, their second album. They both come out around the same time, and I remember I had discovered Testament, and I was like, oh my God, you guys got to check out this album. And we're like, oh, the Pleasures of the Flesh is awesome. You know, and there was this whole argument about which one was better, you know, but it was always a constant pushing, with my friends at least, to discover new bands, you know, and you'd bring them back, and again, yeah, you'd see if your friends dug what you were bringing back, or they'd reject them, and, you know, you'd have that, Snow White was another band I remember bringing back to them and saying, look at this band, this crunchy guitar, and they're like, we don't like them, you know?
Well, guys, a few more questions, but I just want to remind the listeners that they should all be checking out this documentary. It's the definitive history of thrash metal. Get Thrash, the story of thrash metal, out September 16th, just a few days from now. And you can purchase it online too, right? GetThrash.com?
Yeah, GetThrash.com. There's a link. And Lightyear.com is actually where they're selling, you know, doing the pre-sales. So that's a good place to buy it, because Lightyear was pretty much one of the only labels that would take a chance and sign us, essentially, and give us a deal. And, you know, so we're thankful to them for putting this out.
Now, you kind of hinted at this earlier, but I can imagine, like, there were many legal issues. I mean, publishing and just the rights and clearances. When just knowing from having worked in television on music, it had to be a nightmare.
Yeah, it was an absolute nightmare, and I cannot imagine ever doing something like this again. The way that it was done, which is very DIY and independent of any big, you know, corporate sponsorship or support. Yeah, I mean, to use any of the music in the film by the big bands, but the music we love and we know, you have to not only go to the band, but you have to go to the record label to get their permission. You know, Exodus.
Publishing,
yeah. And a lot of times it's not up to the band. Most fans think, oh, yeah, Exodus would, you know, be dying.
Cool with that. Right.
Yeah, Exodus, they are dying to be in this, and they would love for us to use all of their music, but they don't have necessarily the rights to say, yeah, go ahead, use our music. You know, Sony or whoever owns the publishing, they have the final say. And as you know, as much as we want to think that you know, it would help them to sell albums by having their music in the documentary, sometimes it doesn't work out quite that way when you're talking to some of the big record labels, especially on the budget that we had. You know, this is an independent film, so we really, I really had to go and get the bands directly involved to get permission to use this music. And even at that, it was difficult. So literally, it was calling Metallica's management and explaining to them, we need your help to come in and let us use this music. And calling, you know, Mille from Creator or Gary Holt from Exodus. Literally, I would have to call them to get them involved to push the process forward. Megadeth, Anthrax, basically all of them. The smaller labels were really cool, and I think there's definitely a fine line between like a Metal Blade and Universal. Everybody was cool in the end, but there's definitely a lot more work with Universal because of the corporate structure as opposed to like Metal Blade, where you can get Brian Slagle on the phone.
Right. Now, is this something called a favored nations
yes.
clause that you guys had to deal with where, for example, you would have to pay a band that Metal Blade is handling the same amount that you're paying the Universal? I'm not sure how that works.
You just summed it up. That's exactly how it works. So if one band or one label comes in and says, we want more than everybody else, you know, that's a problem.
You've got to pay everybody.
Because then everybody else has to get that rate, and then your whole budget goes up. And we had issues that came close to being big problems and having to lose stuff from the film. But in the end, thankfully, it all worked out. You know, it worked out thanks to the bands and, you know, honestly, thanks to some of the MTV friends that I've met over the years that have gone on to work in other places. I can't imagine anybody doing this film without having contacts and connections because it was a lot of work on that end to get it done.
I mean, Rick and I would talk all the time during this whole the years that it took to put this together. And the reason why it's coming out in 2008 is because most of that time wasn't spent really on editing so much as it was that maybe have been 10% of the time, and the rest is on administrative legal stuff that has to be done.
Right.
No one wants to do it, but we have to. We have houses and families that we do not want to lose. You know? And even though these guys are all our friends and everything, you know, it's not Gary Holt's decision. It's
the label.
Sony
or like, whoever. Yeah. And then, I mean, there's not only do you have the audio portion of it, but then there's the video footage that is equally insane with clearing. And I know, Rhett, some of that was your personal footage, right?
Some of it, Not a great deal of it, but someone like Walter Morgan is a perfect example who shot stuff of Exodus and Suicidal during the day, and he was kind enough to donate it to the film, clear of any royalty payment or anything like that. However, the band still do have to approve.
Yeah, exactly. Walter Morgan is probably the best example of a fan and now a friend who we met who actually was in the Bay Area at the time this whole scene was exploding, and he shot a lot of great footage. Most of the footage in the film is actually his. And, you know, I had kind of come across him through working with Testament. He's actually good friends with Chuck Billy, and he's roadied for the band, known them forever. And, he's a perfect example of a fan who said, I want to help. I want this story to be told in the right way, and I have these gems, these jewels that nobody has ever seen before, and I would love for you to use them. And Walter's name is, you know, at the beginning of the film. Like, he was invaluable to this process and to the video footage, which we, again, went back then to the bands and said, are you cool with us using this? And, you know, they all were.
Cool.
We have so many kids who have the big rock star dream that they're either going to get rich and famous and make millions of dollars. And one of the things that I thought was interesting about Get Thrashed is that's really the exception for people who are musicians and love music. And there's so few people, even big bands that we know of, that never really made a lot of money at this, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, Rat. And
that's the next film I'm working on. Believe it or not, is what happens to people when they get into the entertainment business. It's very disillusional from both ends, from the artist end who is trying to do something that they're a talent maybe they're born with, to the record company or someone in the industry who's trying to develop that and consequently profit off of that.
it's a very, very difficult business. It's a deep subject and something that's never going to actually have a resolution to it. Because, you know, you have, as you guys well know too, you know what, just even being in a band with other musicians, trying to survive just with the members and their little personal differences can be the end of a group before you even experienced what the industry may do for you or not. You know, it's the hardest business in the world in my mind.
Yeah,
it really is.
Definitely. Yeah. And tell us about some of your other films.
Well, I have another film out that I released probably a year ago. It's called Born in the Basement. It's a kind of a, it is my autobiography. It tells the story of what I experienced in those very early days of putting together, which was Overkill, a band during that time period in the tri-state area amongst the cover bands in New Jersey, and the culture kind of changes that were going on between the disco scene fading out and new wave and punk, and so also everyone was just kind of tail spinning, and so it's just something that maybe in a way sort of a compliment, so to speak, to get thrashed, much more of a personal kind of journey, but that's something that I have out at ratskates.com. You can get that, or it is in some retailers too.
Cool. And we will link that through today's show notes.
And Rat, thank you for putting the comment on my MySpace page. I was psyched when I saw that.
Thank you. Actually, thank you, Steven.
Oh, very cool.
Yes.
In the same line as Mark's original question, John Connolly, I believe it was saying how you go out on tour for 3 months and then you got to come back and you got to get a job for 2 months and then you go back on tour. And then when you try to get another job, they're saying, well, how long did you work at your last job? And he's like, well, 2 months. So it's just, and Richard Christie said the same thing when we had him on Talking Metal, is that, you know, it's really just hard to make a living, even if you're in a band that's touring. I always thought that if you had an album out at the record store that you were, like, all rich and it was, like, a big deal. But I found out now that that's not the way it is.
No, I mean,
it's really hard. But
show business has always been about the smoke and mirrors and putting that entertainer up on a pedestal. And sometimes you will get the people that have been through an awful lot that will share with you really what life is about. You know what? You may view me a certain way. You hear my records, see me on stage, but I have a day job to make ends meet. A fantastic, one of the best movies I've ever seen is the story of the Anvil movie. I don't know if you guys have seen that.
I have not seen it yet.
See it. It's phenomenal. It's a documentary slash movie. It's funny. Spinal Tapish doesn't mean to be, but it's incredible. And it's very humbling because, related to what we're talking about, Lips, you know, you view him a certain way as, okay, Anvil's not the biggest selling band ever, but, you know, is he able to make a living? When you see this movie, wow, does it put things in perspective how hard it is.
Yeah,
very humbling.
Definitely.
Yeah. Great movie.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, guys. And again, the website's getthrash.com. Ratskates.com.
Ratskates.com.
We will have both of those linked. Pick up this DVD. You will enjoy it. It is one of the really only historical lessons, history lessons, if you will, on thrash, in my opinion, that's you know, out there, right?
Yeah, it definitely is. And when people ask me, you know, is it you know, is it for thrash fans, is it for mainstream, I love to say that on the same level as Some Kind of Monster. If you were a Metallica fan, you'd love it. If you were a mainstream fan, you'd really like it. I think Get Thrash is the same way. If you're a thrash fan, you've got almost 200 minutes of, like, thrash band footage, history and whatnot that you will just, you know, I think eat up. And if you're a non-thrash fan as well, there's a lot to be taken out of this. You know, again, from the stuff on the road to the fans to the culture to the bands and why this was important. If you're a music fan, you know, you should check it out because, you know, there's a lot of good music here that you may have missed.
Definitely.
I think it actually should be required viewing for everybody who's in the media industry and fans alike.
Agreed.
That's awesome, John. We're going to use that on our website.
Yes.
Very good. Let's end today's interview with some classic Overkill, Rotten to the Core. Any memories? 1984, the four-song EP?
Yeah, you know, all just fun memories because those early days before you had the pressures of selling a certain amount of units and touring, which is why I left the business at that time, it was all about fun. So to sum it up, it was a fun time, and the songs were written with just, you know, four guys just having clear heads and just thinking about, you know what, just all about headbanging, going out, shredding, having fun, and that's the memory. It's, I'm very fortunate and blessed to have experienced, really.
Very good. Yeah. Thank you, Rat. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, guys.
All right.
Again, check out getthrash.com. Here is a little old school Overkill going back to 1984.
A secret hidden behind my eyes, a violation, tragedy of violence, hate and lies. Locked deep within the chamber, dark recesses of my mind, a tribute to insanity through our days and time. Bastard to the core. Bastard.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.